This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today I have with me
Graham Slater.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Graham, you came to Palmerston North in, was it 1960?
Yeah. So I was born in Taranaki and my dad, I was born on a dairy farm, and my dad couldn't make a fist of farming, so he went back into the army after the war. And so he went into the army in New Plymouth, and then eventually we got transferred to Wairu, so we shifted to Wairu until 1959-1960, and then he got transferred to Linton.
Yeah.
So okay. I've pretty much been here off and on since then.
Okay. Now, you remember Wairu then? Did it seem cold to you? No.
Wairu was a wonderful place to grow up because as a kid, there was so much to do. There was so much mischief you could get into.
Really?
A military camp. There were places you shouldn't be. There were places you shouldn't, things you shouldn't do.
Okay.
And I liked doing those things. And so,
You want to elaborate on that?
Well, there were places where you weren't supposed to go.
Oh,
There were places where there was armaments lying around. And
But
I made friends with the son of the head shepherd of a big farm on the other side of Wairu, and so I spent a lot of my spare time on this massive sheep farm, which basically took up the left-hand side of the desert road, so it went up in amongst the Kamanawa horses and towards the mountain. It was a really great place to be a kid.
So you were super fit and good lung and muscle development.
Got into lots of trouble because I would spend all day on the farm, and my dad, being army, had pretty rigid, we have a dinner here at 6 o'clock, and if I didn't get home for dinner, I didn't get fed.
Yeah.
And of
course, it doesn't show. So that was good. So how did you feel about coming to Palmerston North? Was that a plus or a minus?
Well, we'd lived in small places. You know, Stratford was pretty, you know, tiny compared to this, and Wairu was just a village in those days. And, a village that's subsequently been demolished. It's if you go through what was the housing area I grew up in, it's all gone. They completely demolished it. So coming to Palmerston North was moving to the big city, really, from us. Mm-hmm. So my parents enrolled me at Murris Brothers High School. So from 1961 to 65, I was at intermediate and high school at Murris.
And what was that? A shock, a large school, and more rigid
discipline? Yeah, it was. Rigid discipline. The Maris Brothers in the 1960s, the cane was the instrument of torture of the day, and they were fairly adept and happy to wield it whenever they needed to.
Yeah. So what was your feeling about that? That was just normal, was it?
Well, because coming from a family with a military dad who was quite authoritarian, I expected have a hard, you know, to be...
You expected to be punished because it wasn't going to stop misbehaving.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You had to find the boundary somehow, sure.
So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Test the boundaries and see what...
And so you find out how far you can go before you get thumped.
Yeah.
It's the same at school as it was at home, really.
But, okay. So, but it was obviously a much larger school, was it?
It was quite a large all-boys school, which is... morphed into become St. Peter's, which is co-educational now. It was a good school from the people point of view. It wasn't a very good school from an education point of view. The Maris Brothers, in my opinion, weren't the best teachers. So it was a good place to grow up, get good friendships, establish into a community that I'm still living in today.
And I was going to say, you found for you, I came from overseas and I was at the university. My impression was everyone had only recently come here, until I found there's actually generations of people who've grown up here. So for you, there was a Palmerston North community that you got to know at school.
Yeah.
And has there actually been been retained? A lot of those people are still here?
There's not many of them. There are still a few people. Mostly I encounter them at funerals these days, which is a sad situation. But yes, I mean, yeah, a lot of people that I went to school with, you still run into.
But I suppose it's more the farming families would have been stable in this area, rather.
Yeah, there was a lot of... when we first got here, it was a much more rural place than it is. The population has probably doubled since we got here.
Yes,
A significant change to the whole thing, yeah.
And you'd remember the train going through the middle of the square?
Yes, the train still went through the middle of the square when we moved here. Which was a bit of a revelation, really, to drive around the square and suddenly be confronted by a dirty, great, steaming black locomotive that was puffing its way through the square.
That's right. Yeah, intriguing. I think it was the AA was responsible for traffic management or something,
was it? Yeah, they didn't seem. I don't know. Looking back, there didn't seem a lot of traffic management. I don't ever recall too many accidents. I think Palmerston North people, because there was a train through the middle of the square, were very cautious.
Yeah, they knew to look out.
And because you ran into it twice. You ran into it by the old post office and around by the commercial hotel where the railway station used to be. So the railway was very much a middle part of the city. Right through this mechanism.
But it always go quite slowly through?
It went through slowly. As I say, people respected the fact that the trains had the right of way.
Did you get children playing chicken? And
I wasn't aware of it, but probably did.
So you went to school here. Were there many other activities when you were at school here?
Well, I was very much involved in sporting activities. I played rugby and cricket and tennis and athletics, squash. So, I actually found my niche really in sporting activities rather than academic activities place. So.
Which would be quite common for New Zealand.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was something that we drift into quite easily. My dad played rugby and was coaching a rugby team at Linton when I was growing up. And so it was sort of the weekends were given over to rugby and there were practices during the week. And it just became part of life,
Now, of course, you were talking about the time of the big New Zealand weekend, wasn't it, where loads of things closed down, and it was supposed
very much so. Friday night was an amazing place in Palmerston North in those days, because Friday night was late night shopping. Nothing was open in the weekends.
You couldn't
move in Broadway on a Friday night.
So everyone would go. I suppose they're working during the day, and then we've got to do the shopping for the weekend and for the week. Yeah. Was it food shopping or any old shopping?
One of the things that I recollect quite strongly was Christmas Eve in Palmerston North. They used to shut Broadway, and people would walk down the...
You mean they pedestrianised the street? They won't do it now.
And you couldn't move. It was just, everybody seemed to be a place to go.
So your father was in the army. Did you find much of an army connection with the school? Or that was quite...
The school had a cadet corps. And because my dad was in the army, it was expected that I would play some role in that.
Many other army children? Did you see yourself as a army child?
Definitely not. I mean, my dad had these ambitions that I was one of eight kids. I'm number two of eight.
Number two.
And my dad had intentions for us all to do trades and then go into the army in a trade, because he felt that was a really good, secure life. He had picked out for me to become a motor mechanic. I didn't like having dirty hands, and so...
And the idea of it being chosen for you anyway.
What I did, much to my father's disgust, was I hiked off in my last year at school and I arranged an electrical apprenticeship for myself.
Yeah.
And then went home and said to Dad, this is what I'm going to do. You need to sign this piece of paper. Because he had to basically agree to the whole thing. So he grudgingly signed it, and that started me at the end of school as an apprentice electrician.
Yeah.
The subsequent brother got pushed into being the mechanic the next time.
yeah.
Okay. They got his way.
So with the military, I suppose those outside it have the idea. Military, that means you might go off to war and risk your life and so on. It was seen more as a training ground for trades.
Yeah, my dad was a training engineer rather than he'd served during World War II.
Yeah.
And he would have been too old to go to Malaysia and Singapore and those other conflicts. So he was really seen as, you know, he was part of the cadet school, training school in Wairu, and the engineering school here at Linton when we got here.
Yeah. So a lot of the military career could very probably be non-combat, basically.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, my dad was in the engineering group, and so they did Bailey Bridges and that sort of thing. So, which
would be good fun, I should think.
Yeah, I mean, that's just big Meccano sets, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I could imagine. There was no, I suppose in those days, not that many people would go to university anyway, but there wasn't an idea of valuing the intellectual?
No, there wasn't. I mean, my parents didn't really place a lot of store on education, to be honest. I'm still the only person of my family that has a degree. None of the others actually ever did anything more. So education was just something that you had to get through to get yourself into a trade, to get yourself a life, really.
So what was their, and this is jumping ahead, but you became a lecturer at Massey. What was their reaction to you going down that? Did you think you distanced yourself from
them? My dad wasn't that pleased. Because he had visions of it as an electrician that I would wire houses and that sort of thing, and you know, he had a preconceived notion of what an electrician was. What happened in reality was I served my 10,000 hours apprenticeship and then left the day I finished and went and got a job in the Dairy Research Institute as an instrumentation technician, starting to learn about electronics and control systems and that sort of thing.
So is that a big jump from your training? Were you using much of your training then?
Yeah, still using a lot of it, yeah. Okay. But it was expanding it.
So it's not narrowing to a specialisation, no, it was actually broadening.
It's widening it out into the industrial electronics area, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So you know, that was quite an intriguing place. We did a lot of laboratory work and
you'd suddenly meet a lot of people from overseas.
Changed how I see the world, yeah, definitely. And academics and people with PhDs and so the world suddenly changed.
So how did it open up your perception? You thought these are strange people, I didn't realise you can make a living doing
this. They were strange people. They spoke a different language.
Yeah. You mean the technical language, or they're not native
some of
English?
It, some of it's a technical language, and some of it's an almost an elitist,
You felt there was a sort of social hierarchy once
I
you
did.
Got to the
I
unit.
Very much did, yeah. Okay. Between technicians and professional people in those industries.
Yeah.
I didn't feel that there was any denigration went on, but there was definitely
just
lines
a difference.
Of. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Right. I noticed that it surprised me when. In my first few days at the university, and there was a common room, and so I go in for sort of morning coffee or whatever, and I started talking to someone who happened to be one of the secretaries, so just carrying on the conversation, I sat down, and I found a whole circle of women glaring at me because I'd sat down in the secretary's circle. But towards the later on, there wasn't that sort of distinction we all seemed to make.
I think it eased up over time, actually, but I mean, I felt the same when I first, because when I went, when I first went to Massey, I was the AV technician for education, and the only people I knew that were the people that had interviewed me, and so when it came to morning tea, I went and had morning tea with them, but there was this place where the technicians sat and where the academics sat, and right from the start I was sitting in the wrong place.
But
my friends were in the wrong
place.
But
allowed it.
They allowed it. And I think to some degree it eased things, though. Because what I'd do was chop and change.
Well, we found it great. If you can sit down over coffee with the technicians and you ask about what's the latest computer coming out, what sort of laptop should I get? It was very helpful.
It was good. So I think it changed over time. It got better and easier.
So from your background then, did you feel, you know, I'm mixing with a load of intellectuals and some of the carryover from your father's attitude?
Yes, and I got quite ambitious about what happened was when I was working in education, one of the lecturers said to me, did you know that when you work at Massey that they'll pay for you to do a degree? Yeah. They did in those days.
Okay, yes.
And I said, no.
They still
no,
do.
I wasn't aware of it.
Well, they
still
they don't pay you. No. They pay the fees.
Yeah. And so I enrolled in a paper, just one paper, just to see. Mm-hmm. And it was the most amazing experience in my whole life. It completely turned my life on its ear.
Yeah.
It was a paper called Human Development in Education.
Oh,
it was
right.
taught by a guy by the name of Brian Shaw, who was the most amazing teacher I ever encountered.
Yeah.
And at the end of that year, I was convinced that's where I wanted to head. It took 20 odd years after that to get there. But that
so sort of a paper a year to
a paper
yeah.
a year. To do that, that's just to do a bachelor's degree.
Yeah.
And then and by then I'd moved through a few different employments.
Yeah.
And came back to Massey. I was at IPC for a while and with the City Council for a while. But when I came back, one of the guys in media studies at that stage was being set up, and he came and he said to me, look, if you were interested in presenting and in preparing and presenting an applied paper in media studies, we would get you a job as a tutor.
Excellent.
Now that was a completely different world. So,
and suddenly you find you're standing in front of a load of students.
Yeah.
This question came up. Was there any training as to how to do that?
There wasn't really. Although its colleagues were really good, and the staff development at Massey was very useful at the time in terms of understanding how to prepare. We didn't do a lot of. I didn't do extramural teaching at that stage, and it was very much face to face.
Yeah. And were you panic-stricken at first?
Hell yes. Yeah, the first time I stood in front of a class, I'm not sure who was more surprised, me at seeing all of them or them seeing me standing there, not sure where to go.
Yeah.
But it's almost like there was a switch after a wee while, and I looked around and said to myself, okay,
I can do this.
I can do this. And it started, and it was a most wonderful time of my life.
Good.
It was really rewarding, satisfying, and great. Yeah.
If you get attentive students who are interested in the subject.
Yeah, I taught papers that weren't compulsory, I didn't have anybody there that had to be there. They were there because they wanted to be. And so I had these motivated students.
Yeah. What sort of size class did you have?
Between 30 and 50 people, which is probably too many for what I was doing. But a lot of the students that I encountered through there, I still are friends with, and I still run into people and communicate with them. So some good relationships came out of that the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I know. Now you're researching various history topics, but as an academic, were you doing research as well?
I was. I did my master's degree on television news. I did a participant observation on TV news, where I went into the newsrooms and lived in the newsrooms in Auckland and Wellington for a couple of weeks, and went out on stories and carried cameras and helped do interviews and that sort of thing, just to understand why and how the news got made, and did a thesis that looked at, is it really news or what is it?
How far is it guided? Yeah.
It's
your conclusions were?
Well, it's a commodity. It's something that gets produced every day at a particular time.
Okay.
Fits a particular time slot.
Yeah.
So it can't be too interesting. You have to edit it down.
Oh, yeah. It's entertainment as well as.
Yeah, it has to attract an audience and it has to fit between 6 and 7.
And now this relates to the issues of the information, a lot of information people get on, I suppose, policies, political issues and so on, is through the news.
Yes.
But at the same time, the news has to be something that some current, if you want to publicise an issue, you have to have a demonstration or something that's newsworthy.
Yeah.
So did you feel that people were being informed through the news, or... It was more giving out.
Being informed, but I think the news is still today is a device which is used by politicians and businesses, etc., to promote their ideas.
Yes.
You know, I mean, one of the things that was quite obvious when I was doing my thesis was that we would have, at 9 o'clock in the morning, we'd have a meeting to decide what was on the news at 6 o'clock that night.
Yeah.
And that's what would happen, unless at 10 past 5 a politician released a paper on such and such, and then the whole news bulletin would go bop, 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 and things would get bumped off the bottom of it,
yes,
so that,
okay,
the vital information could be put somewhere in the bulletin.
Now, one thing in the I suppose the theory or the analysis of these things is the order of about what is selected and what's the order. So were you in touch with...
Yeah, and it's quite interesting. My hypothesis was, of all the things that happen in the world today,
yeah,
what's important about the things that make it to the news?
Is it if it bleeds, it leads?
I'm afraid it is. There are, yeah, some things that make it to the news. Fires, yeah, and accidents and,
yes,
assassinations and that sort of thing. Floods.
Yeah.
But lots of people have to be devastated by something. If it's a small flood in Kaitaia and somebody's car, yeah, gets washed out...
Hmm.
That's not important.
That's not enough.
No, it has to be a major thing before it reaches a threshold on the news.
Yeah.
And it's not much different today, to be honest.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, if it's changed much. But
No, the criteria
is... Except now you've got... there's far fewer people doing the reporting.
Well, that's right, yeah. And the internet's changed that whole thing as well. I mean, whereas, yes, what you were getting was an analysis on a story by a reporter.
Yes.
What you're now getting is analysis on a story by somebody off the street, which puts it into a format in the electronic media that isn't necessarily... It's an opinion rather than something that's been researched and interviewed people about it.
Yes, yeah. Well, I've found in some of the involvement with, as an academic, you get, say, the, what's it, 15-minute slots in the current affairs,
yeah,
programs, you know. You get, yeah, a team of people would have 2 weeks to do the 15-minute thing,
yep,
and they might know nothing about,
yep,
the topic before they start,
yep,
and they've got to package something together somehow.
Yeah.
Which,
one of the other things that I really found quite intriguing about when I did my thesis was that I looked at a minute-by-minute analysis of a news hour.
Yes.
And it turns out that bugger all of it, if you pardon the expression, is actually news. Because if you look,
yes,
at, there's headlines, there's previews, there's advertisements.
15 to 20 minutes of ads,
yeah,
yes.
Yep. There's news stories.
And the last 5 minutes is always some fluffy...
yeah, kick them out on a high is the idea. One of the ideas is don't leave people feeling miserable.
Yeah.
You give them all the bad news.
And then find something quirky. Yes, yeah, I did tell you, if they want to interview for something and they're going to stick you in the last 5 minutes, you know, they're,
yeah,
not going to be serious.
And they tend now to use, yeah, 7sharp and things like that to...
Yes.
To bookmark those, bookend those things, but
yeah,
so nothing's really changed. But the news is a sausage factory, in my opinion, and they're just,
yeah,
turning out a product,
yeah,
which is paid for by advertisers, fits a particular slot on a particular day.
I did notice that with New Zealand, some of it, personality can be more important. You've got a few people who are defining for New Zealand,
yeah,
how to look at various issues,
yeah,
and they're very conscious of that. Whereas,
yeah,
in a larger market like the UK, there's so many different people.
That's right.
That one cannot.
Yes, you do tend to get specialised. One of the people that the political reporter when I was doing my analysis was Linda Clark.
Oh yes.
And she's subsequently become a solicitor. She was amazing in terms of the insights that she managed to get,
yeah,
and then she'd go and interview a politician and so
she was very well informed.
Oh, particularly well informed, and she put people in very difficult places.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she was amazing to watch. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because when I came, there was Sharon Crosby, was,
yeah,
one of the,
yeah,
and then she,
yeah,
went overseas and.
Yeah,
and she came back. Didn't go,
yeah,
back.
Yeah, there's still a few of the people that were,
yeah,
that I interviewed. That's part of my thesis,
okay,
working in television today. But
a lot of, yeah, it tends to be young people.
Well, it is now. I mean, what they've done in the last year is they've TVNZ look like they've trashed everybody that gets paid more than they think they should get paid, and there's a lot of young people coming in, but there's some great talent coming along.
Yeah.
Is,
but the experience
you can't replace. Yeah. I don't think.
I was going to say with the say newspaper journalism, it was a lot. I thought the older ones with a lot to teach the younger ones, but these days I found in the journalism academia they say, well, people, they get trained, they spend a couple of years on a newspaper or something, after which they go into PR because there's higher salaries.
Yeah.
And, and putting out the press releases that
they do. They go into PR and they become press agents for politicians, where they then formulate the stories that get inserted into the news bulletin that knocks everything else down the line. So it's a complete circle that goes on.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you look at the number of people that were politicians that have become advisors and the journalists that have become PR people, it's a very controlled world, I have to say.
Very
much so.
Yeah. Okay, so you did a thesis, you did some lecturing. We're nearly at time, but I know you were doing things with the with the Regent, with the
Through this whole thing, actually, I became quite interested, mostly due to my wife towing me along into live theatre. And because I was an electrician in early days, and you needed to be an electrician to do much lighting in those days, I got involved quite early in my life in theatre lighting.
Okay.
And right through that whole time, I basically worked nights in theatres in this city, Centrepoint, and the Regent, and the Opera House, as the lighting technician.
Right.
So I've 20 or 30 years of working nights, doing a completely different career.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Oh, was that paid, you mean, or voluntary?
I was paid, yes. It was. Okay. It wasn't paid particularly brilliantly, but it was paid.
Yeah. And you meet all sorts of visiting performers from overseas?
Yeah,
amazing. Any standout one?
Oh, people, thousands of them.
Okay. Okay. Well, sidetrack then. You ended up going, was it to Australia with...
One of the side shots was I was working in the Regent Theatre as the house electrician when Jesus Christ Superstar came around. Mm. And after the first performance, the travelling electrician said to me, "We need another Sparky on the tour. Would you like to join us and spend the next year touring Australia and New Zealand with Jesus Christ Superstar?"
A whole year.
Which we did. Wow. And it took my family. My son started school in Sydney. It was a truly amazing year. So I just worked nights.
So he was sort of, the family were based in Sydney and you'd...
We did Adelaide, Perth, Brisbane, Sydney.
So when you say your son started school in Sydney...
He turned five when we got to Sydney, so we were on the road, and we were in between.
Oh, I see. So you did the
months.
Mobile. Schooling correspondence.
He joined a school, Marrickville School in Sydney, because that's where he turned five.
Yeah.
And a school of about 1,200 kids, and he was one of about six that spoke English as a first language. It was like being in a foreign country.
Oh, wow.
It was truly amazing.
And then he moved on from, as you moved, he moved to other schools?
Sydney was the end of the tour from that.
Oh, okay.
So we came back to New Zealand, and I went, I was on leave without pay for the DSIR in those days. And I just went back to my old job, which was really strange. Right.
This is part one of two. Listen next week for part two.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz. If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.